Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the LaRouche Show. This is Saturday, June 16th, 2007. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. I'm with the Economic Section of Executive Intelligence Review News Service. And today's topic concerns an update and discussion of many Russian strategic initiatives in this very tumultuous world. And the topic you may have seen on our website in particular is that we're discussing bearing straight toward Cheney's impeachment. You'll hear more on that in just a moment, but first I'm going to welcome our guests, and I'm so pleased that in the studio with me is our Executive Intelligence Review News Service Russian and East European Director, Rachel Douglas. Welcome, Rachel.
Hi, Marcia.
And then we have a coast-to-coast LaRouche Youth Movement panelist today out on the Pacific Coast in Seattle. We welcome Alicia Ceritani. Hi.
Hi, thanks for letting me be on.
And in Boston here on the East Coast, Matt Ogden. Welcome, Matt.
Hello.
And our discussion today takes place in a countdown to a very important event, June 21st, which is going to be another international webcast by Lyndon LaRouche, based out of Washington, D.C., but internationally interactive on the Internet. It's at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, and you can find that on LaRouchePAC.com, LaRouchePAC.com. It's billed as the world's biggest loose end. And we might be talking about many things, but one thing is we have a loose end of the world financial system that's unraveling at record speed and a tremendous strategic crisis on what's going to be happening. Now, I also alert you to something you should look at on our own website. That's LaRouchePub.com or LaRouchePAC.com. On the 14th, that was three days ago, June 14th, there was an international internet event based out of Mexico where a trade union grouping hosted Mr. LaRouche and a discussion on globalization, defeating globalization, what it is, how its nature, its political and economic nature. Have a look at that. You can see that. You can hear that, or you can see a transcript of that. And the other thing, before we launch this discussion, is just released in hard copy from the printer is a 30-page pamphlet that is from the LaRouche Political Action Committee, LaRouchePAC.com, and its title is A Strategy for War Avoidance, LaRouche's Trip to Moscow. That is, it reports on Lyndon LaRouche's travels. He's got back recently, where in May he was at a Moscow conference. He also, on his way back, spoke in Rome to various groupings there. He was there for 3 days at a Senate grouping concerned with defense and the economic situation. And what's needed is for people, certainly you want to get this, contribute resources to it, but we need war avoidance urgently. And that brings us to having Rachel begin the discussion, who accompanied Mr. LaRouche in Moscow in May. And this was at a celebration of Stanislav Menshikov, his 80th birthday, a longtime economist statesman in Russia, whose book in English came out a couple months ago, and Rachel translated, which is The Anatomy of Russian Capitalism. She can say more about the man, the policy, and the events. But this is just the most recent time Rachel's been in Russia. She's been back and forth for decades and up to many things. But what I'd like to do is, Rachel, why don't you start off with the most recent initiatives of LaRouche, and that brings us also to President Putin, but what was going on in May?
Yes, well, the pamphlet that Marcia refers to here, The Strategy for War Avoidance, is itself a report on LaRouche's trip to Moscow. It was 1 month ago yesterday that LaRouche was the guest of honor at Professor Menshikov's jubilee celebration of his 80th birthday. That event took place at the Russian Academy of Sciences on the Lenin Prospect, one of the few things in Moscow that still has its Soviet name and some of its decorations. But the Academy of Sciences goes back much farther than Lenin, the Soviet Bolshevik revolutionary. The Academy of Sciences was founded 300 years ago under the rule of Peter the First, Peter the Great, in Russia, in 1725, the last year of Peter's life. And it was founded according to recommendations of the great scientist Gottfried Leibniz from Germany, who, as readers of EIR and members of the LaRouche movement know, was also conceptually one of the founding fathers of our republic. So right there in that historical point of LaRouche being at the Russian Academy of Sciences, we have reference to one of the underlying elements of past and potential Russian-American cooperation, which was a major theme of Mr. LaRouche's trip to Moscow. Listeners may find that surprising for me to say right at this time, because, as you know, Marcia, especially since Putin's speech last February, he attended in person the Munich Security Conference, used to be called the Verkunde Meeting. Putin spoke there on February the 10th of this year in very tough terms. In a speech that he introduced, this is the Russian president speaking, by saying, "I'm so glad to come to this conference, which is not an official government-to-government meeting. It's a conference to discuss ideas about security, because here I can say what I really think." And he proceeded to say that under the arrangement of world affairs since the breakup of the Soviet Union, what some people had called a unipolar world, in the sense of one pole, one superpower, that developments have proceeded in a way that's unacceptable for Russia from the standpoint of its national security. And he discussed this in many respects, both with regard to the economy and the military, came across as very firmly committed to shifting Russia's posture towards what it has seen as adversarial developments. And this is everything from the collapse of Russia's own economy internally to the emplacement of new anti-missile systems of strategic significance in the immediate vicinity of Russia's borders. So this was a complex speech, an important evaluation, a thoughtful one. It was generally treated and glossed in the U.S. press, in the European press, and by State Department and other officials as Putin having an outburst, or Putin suddenly, as if for no reason, launching into a Cold War kind of posture. And this continues up till yesterday. One of yesterday's news items was that a meeting convened by Russia and billed as an emergency meeting on the status of a treaty initially signed in 1990 called the CFE. It has to do with conventional arms levels in Europe. And its implementation has broken down because so many of the countries that were in the Soviet bloc, the Warsaw Pact, at the beginning, at the time that that treaty was signed, are now NATO members, and so there's a significant disbalance. So there were four days of talks on that. It was inconclusive. Maybe talks will resume. But in commenting upon the Russian posture at that meeting, one of the State Department officials yesterday said, "Well, what we heard from the Russians was that Cold War thing, the drumbeat again." And it's portrayed, therefore, to the public here as if what were at issue were merely moodiness on the part of the Russian president. So in the midst of this atmosphere of a Cold War or worse, here comes LaRouche to Moscow as the guest of the Academy of Sciences that has such a history going back to Russian-American cooperation. And Professor Menshikov very deliberately invited Lyndon, selected him as the first of his guests to address the people who were assembled for the celebration of Menshikov's 80th birthday. Menshikov himself, I should say, Professor Menshikov, who was on the LaRouche show 2.5 months ago with Harley Schlanger, just at the time of the appearance of his book, The Anatomy of Russian Capitalism, is one of Russia's leading experts on the United States. His father was the ambassador to this country during the 1950s, Mikhail Menshikov. And Menshikov made his name as an expert on the differentiation within the American leading circles. What's the difference between Wall Street and the Midwest industrialists? Interesting questions of history and current history. He applied some of the tools of analysis that he developed in that area of specialization. He applied them afterwards to studying what happened with the Russian economy after the breakup of the Soviet Union. So here he invited LaRouche. Well, he had a sense of the kind of remarks that Lin would make. And indeed, at that event a month ago yesterday, and in all of the other discussions, including several televised interviews that Lyndon LaRouche held in Moscow, he was the guest on a widely watched portal called km.ru for a webcast interview, or it was actually posted after being recorded. And he was the guest on the weekly economics analysis program on the satellite TV channel of the Russian Orthodox Church, which is something new and was extremely interesting discussion of the global financial crisis. In all of those discussions, what Lyndon LaRouche put forward as the urgent necessity for our country, for Russia, and for the world is that the United States, as a nation, must approach Russia, China, and India, the great powers of Eurasia, with a proposal for a new monetary system be geared towards financing long-term, 20 to 50-year hard commodity production, and in particular, physical infrastructure for the economy of our nations and worldwide. Now, I should say, and this is something Marcia's very much familiar with, and I believe, Marcia, you interviewed engineer Hal Cooper.
Yes, on this show, subsequent to when Professor Menshikov was on and so forth.
Yes, well, because what listeners will have heard Hal Cooper discuss with Marcia is featured on the front of the pamphlet, A Strategy for War Avoidance, that LaRouche Pack has just put out. And what that is a beautiful graphic of the connection across the Bering Strait between Alaska and Chukotka, which is the easternmost tip of Russia. In fact, it's so far east that a little bit of Russia there is actually in the Western Hemisphere, up north there. And we have a very nice projection, not quite a polar projection, but a North Pacific, kind of from where Alicia is in Seattle, a projection of where the two continents come together with a sketch of a railroad, which does not now exist, that would run up through Western Canada, through Alaska, cross the Bering Strait, which is a 100-kilometer narrow neck of water, and run into Chukotka and thence to Siberia and down to the city of Yakutsk, which is about where the railroad now runs to coming from the other side. Now this project, the Bering Strait project, had been the topic of many interventions by Mr. LaRouche over recent years. I think the first national conference in the United States of the LaRouche movement where I remember this being discussed occurred in 1978. Right at the time when, unfortunately, our nation's foreign policy strategy was going the wrong direction under the Zbigniew Brzezinski administration. Brzezinski was Jimmy Carter's National Security Advisor, and among many other things, was one of the first people who pushed what became Project Democracy, that is, promoting all kinds of rotten economic policies for many countries of the world under the banner of saying, this is what you have to do to become democratic. It was a very, very tense period. It was shortly before the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the first Iran hostage crisis, and so forth. And at that conference in 1978, LaRouche commissioned a panel on great projects, building great projects of infrastructure as the pathway to a more stable world, to cooperative relations amongst the great nations, including at that time the Soviet Union and the United States. I remember this very clearly because my assignment was to convey to the audience the enormity of Siberia as an undeveloped frontier.
I'll interrupt her to say, and I watched while Rachel had all these illustrations of the Baikal-Amur Railway, where it would go out into seemingly nowhere.
Yes, and
the other projects.
The Baikal-Amur Railway, which is the second line of the Trans-Siberian, runs kind of north of Lake Baikal. One of the enormity of Siberia facts that I got to report to people is that Lake Baikal contains 20% of the Earth's fresh water, which is a not uninteresting fact given our recent focus on the fact that fossil water is an exhaustible resource, and we'd better think about how to develop such resources as well as how to move to nuclear power and desalination of seawater and so forth. Or that Siberia has not one, not two, but three enormous river systems, from the Ob River in western Siberia. And by the way, I should mention, speaking of great projects, that last weekend at the St. Petersburg Economic Forum held Putin hosted in St. Petersburg, Russia's second biggest city, the president of Kazakhstan, Nursultan Nazarbayev, revived the idea of channeling some of the flow of the Ob River through a system of canals down to Central Asia, which has lost the entire Aral Sea and is very much a water shortage area. This is on the scale of the famous Nawapa project for the Western North American continent, which has never been built. So we presented the potential of the Ob Basin, the Yenisei with its hydroelectric power in central Siberia, and the Lena River in eastern Siberia. And the sketches that engineer Hal Cooper has done or has commissioned of the Bering Strait project include one of its first elements, a bridge, a river bridge across the Lena River at Yakutsk, which would be necessary to take the rail from the Russian side up towards the Bering Strait. Now, so in 1978, that conference panel concluded with a lovely artist's depiction of a bridge tunnel crossing at the Bering Strait. In 1996, EIR published the special report on the Eurasian Land Bridge, a locomotive for a world economic recovery. And our maps there featured the Bering Strait crossing as part of the land bridge network. At least two members of the Russian Academy of Sciences that I'm aware of, academician Rogoff, who heads their institute on the United States, and academician Myasnikov, who's a specialist in Asian affairs, used EIR's map of the land bridge network to illustrate articles that they published in major Russian newspapers on the potential for great projects to help pull the Russian economy out of the deep depression that it had fallen into under the radical free market prescriptions that the IMF, International Monetary Fund, and others brought into post-Soviet Russia. So in the minds of many leading Russian specialists, this concept of a Bering Strait crossing, not in and of itself, but as part of an infrastructure vector recovery of the physical economy of major nations cooperatively, is very much identified with Lyndon LaRouche. So it's no surprise that In April, Mr. LaRouche was invited to attend a conference held the 24th of April on the Bering Strait tunnel. Now, this conference was sponsored by a very interesting organization that goes by its Russian acronym SOPS, S-O-P-S, and it stands for Council for the Study of Productive Forces. And it is a joint undertaking of the Russian Academy of Sciences and the Ministry of Economics of the Russian government. And again, this is quite striking because the Ministry of Economics has continued to be run by somebody who's been in the liberal economic or the neoliberal camp, more of a monetarist, not so interested in physical economic development. And yet the section of that ministry that cooperates in the SOPS took the lead in reviving this spring a push for great projects. It's related to something that President Putin did. On April 10th, the Russian government had a special session on planning railroad development in Russia to the year 2030. And it was chaired by Putin. And at that meeting, Mr. Yakunin, who is the head of Russian railroads, it's the former Soviet Ministry of Railroads, it's been turned into a corporation, but it's still a state-run corporation. Yakunin identified that the 3,500-kilometer rail line from Yakutsk on the Lena River to the Bering Strait is a priority project for Russia. So that's official as a government posture as of April 10th. 2 weeks later, April 24th, the SOPS held its conference under the title Mega Projects of Russia's East, a intercontinental Eurasia-American link, transport link across the Bering Strait. They wanted LaRouche to be there. He was committed to attend Professor Menshikov's jubilee 3 weeks later. Therefore, he sent a paper, which was presented, called Mendeleev Would Have Approved, Mendeleev being the famous Russian scientist who developed the periodic table of the elements, but who during his own lifetime in the late 19th century was better known as an economist, an American system economist, or a national economy economist, and a very vehement opponent of British free trade economics. So Lyndon's paper, Mendeleev Would Have Agreed, was presented at that conference and has subsequently been published in the Russian counterpart to the LaRouche Pact pamphlet, which I should report the existence of. On June 6th, the SOPS put out, or sponsored by the SOPS, came out a special edition of a Russian magazine called Forum International. It's actually bilingual. It's both in Russian and in English. It's 80 pages in color on how the Bering Strait project can change the world. And that, by the way, on if you look on the LaRouche Pack site, and it's also can be found on LaRouche Pub. On LaRouche Pack, they've the young people who run that site have organized it by important topic, and they have a whole section there on the Bering Strait crossing. And on, right above that, you can find a release about Forum International that allows you to view this color magazine in a PDF format. And you'll see there Mr. LaRouche's speech. You'll see a beautiful discussion of great projects as a way to avoid war by Helga Zepp LaRouche, which was included in this pamphlet. And you'll see that leading Russian spokesmen, such as academician Granberg, who heads the SOPS and is one of Russia's leading specialists in the development of Siberia, and Viktor Razbyegin, who's an official at the Economics Ministry, discuss the infrastructure construction in exactly these strategic terms. That is, academician Granberg says, only through cooperation on mega projects can the great powers move away from a course towards military confrontation. This was the content of the ideas going back and forth between Lyndon LaRouche and his hosts a month ago in Moscow.
Oh, that's terrific. Thank you, Rachel. And why don't we go to the Pacific to with some more on this, because, Alicia, you're there in Seattle, and I would be interested in both taking out this kind of perspective, which I know you've been doing, and in organizing, you know, get in opposition to the demonizing of Russia or demonizing of China that's been going on. And also, historically, I understand that our own National Army Corps of Engineers, which is divided into districts, the Seattle district, I know, had the commission in 1942, and they studied how to have the rail link on the North American side up to Alaska, but of course it was never built. But so what do you find the response to this new potential for development?
Well, it's interesting because if you take a look at what LaRouche is talking about with the four major powers and collaboration, specifically in regards to physical development, and you see what just happened at this conference in St. Petersburg, I think China and Russia signed something along the lines of $2 billion worth of contracts for all these different projects. And so you think, okay, well, when is the United States going to start writing contracts and getting, you know, the Army Corps involved and this, that, and the other thing? But the first step in that collaboration would be the impeachment of Dick Cheney.
Right.
It's a nonlinear, you know, you wouldn't see that in the blueprint of any of these construction projects, but it was, you know, the way I describe it in the field with people to try to get them to think a little bit bigger is if you think about the Bering Strait project as a novel, the preface of that book would be the impeachment of Cheney, would be the removal of Cheney. I mean, we got to keep people to think big, and, you know, Cheney's a big guy, but it's a different, you know, a different kind of big. And that's what you get. There's an incredible amount of propaganda against Putin and against the Russians. And it's funny because you can pull out a certain irony in that, is that the media and most people here in the liberal Northwest understand, you know, they have some idea of who owns the media, that it's not the most just apparatus, most honest apparatus. Yet they're continuing to take their advice as a reflection of what the Russians are doing, what Putin's doing. And so the irony is that, you know, they're posing Putin as this guy being contrary, speaking out against a number of different initiatives of the whole global system. You think about it, well, thank God he is. It's great that he is. It's great he's being contrary to a strategy of chaos that a lot of other national leaders have subscribed to. And so you can just sort of challenge what their idea of what the Russians are doing. And they also, in the same breath, they'll be the first people to ask, you know, which is people in the population. We met with Maria Cantwell's aides, a senator out here. And the first thing everybody asks is, well, who's going to pay for it? You know, and so they're still, they know you have this crazy free trade system that the United States is adopting. They're still find themselves in that mindset. They don't think of the possibilities of breaking from it. So when we took this up with the Army Corps of Engineers, there was a couple of members of the youth movement who went and met with them, I'd say something about a month ago. The idea of money to them was like, oh, this is great. This is going to cost, you know, this is going to cost billions of dollars. And I thought, you know what? That's a strange reaction. I thought, well, yeah, it is great because finally we'd be spending on money that actually was oriented towards something worthwhile. You have an incredible amount of money out there that's not attached to anything, but, you know, people also think of money in terms of reduction. We got to spend less money. You want to tax people less. When that's not the case, you just need to reorient it towards something that has a lasting, committed idea behind it. And so these Army Corps of Engineers people, money wasn't necessarily an issue. And when we had given them all the literature we had at that time, which was really just in the beginning of this discussion, it was actually published much earlier, what the organization had done much earlier. So our next follow-up meeting will be much more effective. They had said to one of our organizers, said, you know, look, if our engineers get a hold of this, they're really going to want to do it. They're not going to want to stop. They're going to want to push it. But something they also said to us was that our movement was responsible to make it happen. We would be the glue in the population, with the Congress, and between themselves to make this happen. And so we're still in a process with them. The people we met with have given what we had presented them to their chief of staff, and the follow-up meeting, this is where the discussion came up, is that this youth movement and the LaRouche movement in general, internationally, is going to have to push this and make it happen. So I think that's the relevance. What we're working on right now is the impeachment of Cheney, so you can actually have some creativity in the minds of the Congress.
Please describe, before the show began, Alicia, you talked about a banner that's currently being drawn on the floor of your office in Seattle. Just mention that.
Well, I walked in this morning, and on the floor there was this, I'd say it's about 12 by 4, yeah, about 12 by 4 foot banner of a maglev in motion on the left, the Eurasian land bridge in the middle, and a big picture of a snarling Dick Cheney on the right. And the text was, or is, rather, it's actually being used as we speak, Bering Strait for Impeachment, LaRouchePact.com.
I can't wait to see that one. Thank you. Now, it's important, I'm very glad you put it that way about the preface to the book being the impeachment of Cheney, Alicia. Lyndon talked about this with everybody he met in Russia. That is the question that comes up in people's minds in Russia is, these are wonderful proposals, but you have Bush and Cheney. When we ask leading Russians, what do you see as the obstacle to the Bering Strait connection, for example, being built, they reply, the posture of the United States government. Or similarly, something we should mention that happened also last weekend at the St. Petersburg Forum, which was quite dramatic, came from Putin himself. Maybe you heard this quote from him where he said that the world needs a new economic architecture. Now, those words jump out of the page or off the radio if you hear them. I think Putin was the first head of state, or at least head of state of a really major power, to use exactly that terminology since Bill Clinton in the fall of 1998, when after the so-called Asia financial crisis, which was actually a hedge fund currency attack on the Asian economies that then ricocheted over against Russia, leading to the blowout of the Russian speculative debt pyramid in August of 1998, when Russia declared default on its short-term government bonds, and then, of course, having bet the wrong way on the Russian bonds led to the collapse of long-term capital management hedge fund in Connecticut that IMF head Michel Camdessou and others later admitted nearly brought down the whole system right then and there. That fall, September 1998, President Clinton went to the Council on Foreign Relations in New York and gave a speech in which he said that it appeared urgent that we take steps towards reorganizing the financial architecture of the world. And of course, 2 days later, he had to answer to impeachment, and that agenda was not moved on. But here comes Putin saying, in very, again, tough language, the World Trade Organization is archaic and unwieldy and incapable of making any decisions of any use to anybody. The International Monetary Fund and the World Bank have functioned in circumstances that no longer exist today. And so, says Putin, we need a new financial, a new economic architecture based on mutually beneficial cooperation. And he made a few specific proposals, including the idea, which is quite dramatic if you consider that Russia is one of the world's big oil producers and exporters, that maybe Russia will start denominating its exports in rubles rather than in dollars. But he also put it in a different way. He said, well, maybe we should move to multiple reserve currencies or a regional free trade bloc, a Eurasian free trade organization, rather than what we have now. And there's a question that's begged by that, which is what we were just talking about. What about the United States? When Mr. LaRouche was interviewed by the economist Mikhail Khazin for the Russian Orthodox Church Spas TV channel, satellite TV, he was asked, well, couldn't we just go to some other currency blocks instead of the dollar as a reserve currency?
And Lyndon made in reply the point that it won't work. You cannot solve either the world economic crisis or the strategic crisis if the United States takes a pathway of fascism or a pathway of deindustrialization and self-destruction. So you have to bring about that change. And Mr. LaRouche, with confidence and optimism, kept articulating to his Russian audience, how do you do that? You do it by bringing the outlook of Roosevelt in as the proper American policy, and you do that by breaking with London. And in the discussion with people in Russia, LaRouche said, yes, Bush is a problem. Yes, Cheney is a very big problem. But at the same time, he said, Bush is an idiot who needs to be put under adult supervision. And Cheney needs to be gotten out of office. He then said, however, Cheney is nothing. Cheney is only an instrument of London. I'm quoting now directly from an interview that Lyndon gave to a Russian web publication called RP Monitor. He said, Cheney is an instrument of London because George Shultz, parentheses from me, well known to have put together the Bush administration, is an instrument of London, returning to the quote, is an instrument of London, and George Shultz controls it all in terms of this administration. This whole crowd, this Wall Street crowd, is London. It always has been London. It's always London-oriented. I should throw in here as a serious but also humorous note that when this interview and the one in which Lyndon talked about putting the current president under adult supervision were aired, they were hotly discussed on blogs in the Russian domain of the internet, and one exchange said, did you hear when he said that that the president was an idiot? Did you hear the translator? That was me. She must have been shocked out of her wits. She must have been afraid that if she translated that, she would be disciplined or even liquidated upon return to the United States.
I'm glad you're here, Rachel.
but the point is absolutely serious, that the break with London, with the traditional and current British policies, is essential, because that's what Cheney and his control over the Bush administration have represented. And it's not our topic today, but I can't not mention that as of last night, we here at LaRouche headquarters have available an article which will be appearing in the Executive Intelligence Review dated June the 22nd, a week from yesterday, called Scandal of the Century Rocks British Crown and City of London. People should have their antenna up. This is coming over the horizon. It's very, very big. It has to do with the ongoing investigation of arms contracts and oil deals between BAE Systems, formerly British Aerospace, and the government of Saudi Arabia. And this article is written by Jeff Steinberg. It will be appearing. It will be available on our website very soon.
It's there now, so people can have a look on. It's definitely on LaRouchePAC.com and will otherwise be on LaRouche Pub. It's written by Jeff Steinberg. Thank you. And
so, well, in saying the enemy of Russia is London, which is what Mr. LaRouche said to the Russian people he was speaking with, he said repeatedly what the United States must do is return to Roosevelt. And what's so striking, and I think that both Matt and Alicia have appreciation of this from their political work, is and from keeping an eye on Russia, is that the Putin government and Putin himself personally has been repeatedly citing FDR as if to ask for the United States to make such a change. Vladimir Putin, in his State of the Union speech last year, started it by citing Franklin Roosevelt on how sometimes a president has to trample on the toes of the financial oligarchy, which is, of course, what Putin also has done. And this year, Putin began his State of the Union message, or message to the Federal Assembly, it's called, by citing the words of FDR from the very eve of World War II, saying that when peace is violated anywhere, it's a threat to peace everywhere. That's certainly something Putin and his team have had on their mind with the unfolding of the war in Iraq, the continuing threats of military attack on Iran, which many, many military strategists in Russia perceive as a buildup for a global showdown against Russia itself.
In fact, here's what I'd like to do, unless Alicia or Matt otherwise. Matt, you've been involved in getting out this perspective. I think you've been in touch with people doing it in Washington, D.C., too, on Capitol Hill, of the new Menshikov book, The Anatomy of Russian Capitalism and so forth. And you have something to say on this. But these threats that Rachel, you just mentioned, you've used the expression, they're ringing around, there's an attempt to create provocations ringing around Russia. But first, Matt, what do you want to throw in here about the kind of response you're getting, or institutional response or non-response, when you open up this whole perspective?
Well, I think the tradition of Franklin Roosevelt, that really strikes something with me right now, because just yesterday I finished reading this book by Franklin Roosevelt's son, Elliot Roosevelt, called As He Saw It, the recording of Elliot Roosevelt's participation in all of the wartime conferences between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin, and the leader of China at the time. But it's been shocking and startling for me to go back and dig up everything that shows just how closely, and also just how much potential there was for a cooperation, not just during the war between the United States and Russia, but what Franklin Roosevelt's outlook was for after World War II, that the brotherhood between the United States and Russia could be the key towards a whole new era of peace and development for the world. It's been really shocking for me. It's been very enjoyable, not just looking at the time during World War II, and with Franklin Roosevelt, but even going back much, much further to the cooperation between, all the way back to before the American Revolution, Benjamin Franklin's friends in the Russian Academy of Sciences, the defense of the American revolutionaries by Russia during the Civil War, during the American Revolution against the British, and during the Civil War against the British, the friends of the British and the Confederacy, all the way up into this alliance with Franklin Roosevelt, because in the organizing, going out on the streets, talking to people I know that they have this problem in Washington when they speak to members of Congress who are baby boomers, who were born after the death of Franklin Roosevelt, people express complete brainwashing when it comes to the relationship between the United States and Russia, because everything that they've ever known has been an Anglo-American alliance, an alliance between the United States and the British against Russia. So when you tell them that if the future of the planet depends on a friendship between the United States and Russia against the British, sometimes, especially with baby boomers, it just doesn't compute. With young people, it's a totally different story. And what Alicia said about what the Army Corps of Engineers people that they were meeting with told them, that it's up to us as the LaRouche Youth Movement to organize this thing and to hold this together, I think it's really true, especially between young people in the United States, but also young people who are in Russia, who have a completely different, refreshing sense of what it could be if we go back and dig up this history that's been almost buried and revive this historic brotherhood between the United States and Russia, how optimistic that kind of perspective could be. I wanted to ask Rachel about a recent article that she wrote in the EIR on this subject, about this member of the Duma Mr. Alexander Fomenko, who apparently has been looking at this same question of the historic friendship, what he called a forgotten friendship, between Russia and the United States. Who is this person, and what kind of role is his research having in the kind of actions that the Russian government and Putin is taking now in the relationship to LaRouche?
Well, I think his research, Matt, I'm really glad you mentioned that, because if you hadn't, I was about to, is part of a pattern of people in Russia of many of different generations looking at their own history, including in ways that were not allowed or were very exceptional during the Soviet period. I would just quickly first mention that what you refer to here is central in the discussion that Mr. LaRouche has been having with people at the Academy of Sciences for the last 2 decades. When he was, Lyndon was in Moscow in 1996 at a seminar actually held on the premises of the Free Economic Society, which had been revived from its earlier existence. It was founded by one of those individuals you mentioned who was in correspondence with Benjamin Franklin's networks, the great Russian scientist Lomonosov, who also founded Moscow University in the 18th century. So at Lomonosov's Free Economic Society meeting, chaired on that occasion by academician Abalkin, then head of the Economics Institute of the Russian Academy of Sciences in 1996, Lyndon referred to the relationship between the United States and Russia really starting from when FDR organized the recognition of the Soviet Union in 1934. And he said that what we must do is revive Roosevelt's determination to liquidate the British, French, and Dutch empires after the war and proceed to move towards economic development based on relations amongst the United States, Russia, and China. So that was 11 years ago that Lyndon laid out that perspective, in the discussions with people in the Russian Academy. It's totally delightful and critical that these relative, not so much suppressed, but just not emphasized aspects of history are brought forward in this recent period. The book that you just read by Elliot Roosevelt, of course, includes the descriptions of Winston Churchill having nearly fits of apoplexy in his debate, arguments with FDR over Churchill's demands that the United States act to preserve British imperial prerogatives in the Middle East and elsewhere. Now, that is not something that I, in 35 years of reading the Soviet press, talking to people in Soviet and then Russian circles, had ever heard anybody bring up except for us. And this past winter, there was the date came on January 30th of 30th? No, mid-January of what would have been Franklin Roosevelt's 125th birthday, the 125th anniversary of his birth. It was marked in Russia by a conference held at the Kremlin by the MGIMO, which is the university linked with the foreign ministry, but it was addressed by the deputy chief of staff of the Kremlin, a younger official named Vladislav Surkov. He's one of Putin's advisors, and he brought up after discussing FDR and the wartime alliance with the Soviet Union, he brought up that FDR fought with Churchill over justice or injustice in economic policy in the post-war world. So that was already a signal of the kind of really unusual thinking that's going on. As for Mr. Fomenko, he was elected to the Duma, that's the Russian parliament, on the bloc called Rodina, which means motherland And some EIR readers will remember that that bloc was originally formed by the economist Sergei Glazyev, who's a friend of Lyndon LaRouche, who invited LaRouche in the year 2001 to keynote his Glazyev's hearings in the Duma on how to protect a national economy under conditions of global economic crisis. The Rodina group has subsequently been subject to all kinds of politicking and maneuvers and doesn't exist in the form that it did before. But those were the circles from which Fomienko came in. And his article, indeed, was fascinating. Even things such as that relate to the Bering Strait question, right? Because he did go through the aspects of the forgotten friendship that Matt just mentioned, such as the League of Armed Neutrality that Benjamin Franklin and his friends in France managed to organize the Empress Catherine the Great of Russia to head up during the American War of Independence. They didn't become our allies, but they defended neutral shipping, which was critical to the ability of the colonials, the Continental Congress and its army, to receive supplies from France, who was our ally, and be able to keep on the battlefield. And Fomienko also went through the Civil War era alliance when Tsar Alexander II sent the Russian Navy, sent the fleet to defend the ports of New York and San Francisco against a potential British attack, where the British would have come in on the side of the Confederacy during our Civil War. But he then went into what happened a few years later, which was the sale of Alaska to the United States by the Russian Empire in 1867. And this was negotiated, as Fomienko pointed out, by Secretary of State Seward, that people who were against it and thought Alaska was a piece of useless real estate called it Seward's folly or Seward's icebox at the time. But the point that Mr. Fomienko made was that the negotiations were kept in secret also so the British wouldn't find out. And he quoted actually an Anglophile Russian politician who complained that this deal, taking the Russian Empire out of the Western Hemisphere, meant that the only force remaining to resist the Monroe Doctrine was British territory in the northern part of North America, i.e. that is Canada. Now, think about that for a minute. Throughout the Soviet period, everything I ever read that referred to the Monroe Doctrine, this was the policy adopted by the United States during the presidency of James Monroe. John Quincy Adams, as Secretary of State, drafted it, which said we would not, that the United States would resist the incursion of European imperial powers in the Western Hemisphere in general. The Soviet line on that used to be that it was just American imperialism moving in to replace British or Spanish imperialism. And this author, Fomienko, said, no, let's look at it differently, and made clear that people at the time looked at it differently, saying that America was, by definition, by constitution and by definition, an anti-imperial power, and that in fact, the purchase of Alaska was helping to bolster what was a very important policy globally, strategically. Matt, the other thing I would say in terms of the current policy debate is that Lyndon LaRouche began his contribution to the April 24th conference on the Bering Strait by citing perhaps the most substantial element of the Russian-American relationship from the late 19th century. And he said that the idea of a global rail network extended implicitly across the Bering Strait to North America, The intention to create a Trans-Siberian rail system extended across the Bering Strait dates implicitly from the visit of Dmitry Mendeleev to the 1876 U.S. Centennial Exposition in Philadelphia. And that 1876 Centennial Exposition was organized by the networks of the economist Henry Carey, the heirs, the associates from not so long before, of Abraham Lincoln. And it was a real brainstorming and scientific centering point of scientific ferment, where people came from all over the world to exchange ideas, inventions, and to deliberate on the spread of American system economics as against any imperial economics all over the world. And Mendeleev, who was a scientist, while he was here, discussed railroads, obviously studied railroads, studied the oil industry, which at that time
in Pennsylvania.
Yes, I was going to say,
same
at that
state.
Time it was centered in Marsh's home territory in western Pennsylvania. And he made studies, talked with people in the United States working in agrarian science. Mendeleev, like his later successor, the scientist Vernadsky, was extremely interested in soil types. You know, how does soil, which is a non-living manifestation of matter, how does it function with living matter, and what's the role of organic substances in soil, all these kinds of things which are important for the development of agriculture. And Mendeleev took these ideas to Russia, combined with his own brilliant scientific innovations. And this was the period in which the Russian industry, the serfs had been, the Russian peasant slaves had been freed. There was problems with how that was done. In other words, it wasn't a clean break, and there were social problems in the countryside which weren't immediately resolved. But the directionality of Russian development in those late years of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century was industrialize, become a great nation through the industrial development, and above all, the railroads. And Mendeleev worked closely with Count Witte to take the rail development all the way across the continent in what became the Trans-Siberian Railway, using, of course, the precedent of our transcontinental railway. And Matt, I think that some of the discussions you've been having, maybe in our remaining minutes, you'd say something about them with Russian young people on that history, you know, by looking back 200 years, 300 years to things that have been kept quiet for too long. We're going to be able to make that a contribution to looking forward to the next 50 years.
Absolutely.
So you're in you have a network, or you're networking. Is that the idea, Matt?
This is very interesting because the ideas of Lyndon LaRouche are very powerful. There's not only in Moscow, where there's a group of young people who have organized a sort of internet dialogue forum, which people can look at if they want. It's on a Russian website called methodology.ru, and it's under the forum section. They have a series of questions that were composed under the main question, why does Russia need the United States, and why does the United States need Russia? And so the background of the United States, the background of Russia, and the common challenges and the common projects that we have to collaborate on, there's been a series of postings and dialogues going back and forth about what the views of young people are about both countries and about the relationship. Also, in Ukraine, a very interesting thing is that there's a couple of young women who have been studying LaRouche's ideas very closely. One young woman was here in Boston over the summer last year, and when she went back to Ukraine with the ideas of LaRouche and the time that she spent with our youth movement here and even a discussion that she had with Mr. LaRouche himself, she was shocked to find another young lady who had picked up a paper written by LaRouche about 5 or 6 years ago called A Philosophy of Victory, Can We Change the Universe? She has picked this up and has become very enthusiastic about LaRouche's philosophical ideas and on her own accord had decided to make a presentation of LaRouche's ideas at a conference of young people among campuses from all over Kiev, Ukraine. So these people are now very inspired about what our youth movement is doing here in the United States.
And Matt, I hate to say, this is concluding the hour. I want to thank you all very much, Alicia, Matt, Rachel Douglas, and encourage everyone, listen again June 23rd, 2007 from 3 to 4 Eastern Time. This is the closeout of the LaRouche Show for June 16, 2007. I thank everyone, and do look on LaRouchePack.com for a strategy for war avoidance, LaRouche's trip to Moscow. Thank you all very much.